start to stand. And when you're short, people can't see you anyway when you're sitting down. Sometimes they can't see you when you're standing. So if you don't mind if I sometimes stand, and maybe that'll mess up the mic here. I don't know if that messes up the mic. I chose this title because if you press a fundamentalist or an evangelical Catholic, and I shouldn't put all fundamentalists in the same category, but if you press people, and not all evangelical Catholics are there either, but if you press people about why they don't believe in the ordination of women, they'll usually end up in the story of Adam and Eve. So that story becomes very, very critical. And in fact, I just actually suggested a couple of books to the bookstore people, and they didn't get this one because it's hardcover. But this is a book that you would want to purchase anyway, and it probably will be coming out in paper. This is an older book. It's about 15 years old, God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality by Phyllis Kribble. But I think if you are a woman or a man in the church, and you have some concerns about empowering all of the people of God to share their gifts, really need to take a look at Phyllis Tribble's work, particularly on that Genesis 2, that second story of creation. And it constantly shocks me how many fine scholars of the Old Testament have really hardly studied Phyllis Tribble. It blows me away. When I first heard her for a week in Shalom at Augustana, I heard her lecture for 20 hours. And there were three Hebrew professors there, one of a Catholic seminary, one of a Baptist seminary, and one from a Lutheran seminary. And they'd mutter out in the coffee time, and they'd say, "Well, she really knows her Hebrew." Because she was blowing all of us away, every single one of us. She was blowing us away, and nobody was taking her on her Hebrew. So take a look at her Hebrew scholarship here, and get your life opened up on the story of Adam and Eve in another direction. My daughters, 14-year-old twin daughters, just told me a few days ago that they hate that story. And obviously I haven't spent much time talking to them about what I understand that story to be talking about. But then a second book, which I think is very, very powerful, just pretty recent, came out in 1991, very recent for a lot of people, new book, and shows the mega trends for women and shows the impact of women in all matters of society, religion, politics, sports, fashion. And I thought, boy, I'm not going to be very interested in this fashion chapter. My sisters have to drag me shopping. And I thought the fashion chapter was fascinating. And I didn't think I'd necessarily be all that interested in sports, although I've enjoyed sports because I'm kind of a music person, and sometimes there's a little tension between the music and the sports people about where the money ought to be put. And although the sports section is blew me away, absolutely blew me away. So if you want to have a sense of what is happening for women in the world, and their argument here is there has been so much change for women in the world that we are at a critical mass, which once the critical mass is set loose, which it has been, basically you can't shut it down anymore. Now those we'll be getting into some of those things in later sessions, but let me go a little bit into my story. And let me see, discussion is approximately at 10 after. Is that how it works usually? Or you can break in, but let's probably not break in unless you need something clarified, if I've said something confusing, and then we'll move into the discussion. let me see. Okay, and just wanted to mention one other thing, too. I think part of the power of this issue of women bishop, what has just startled me through this whole election has been the number of people who will walk across a grocery store, a big, huge grocery store, and they'll spot me, and they'll be Jewish or Catholic or a lot of other backgrounds, and run over and tell me how excited they are that I'm a bishop. And the power of that symbol, and I thought a lot about, you know, what is this symbol? What is the power? I think I would be more aware of it if it didn't happen to be that I was the one that had to carry that symbol. It'd be a lot easier to figure out. But I think it's the fascination with the unclean entering the sacred is one of the, and that happened with women pastors, but it just became even more accentuated with women bishops, the unclean entering the sacred. And I think all women are deeply aware of feeling unclean. That is communicated to us from an early age. And I won't go into that. But and then the fascination, I think, with women being in an authority figure, and particularly over men. If you're a bishop, you most of your clergy are, in fact, men. Mm-hmm. And then I think the fact that something completely new happened in the ordination of women, and lots of times I'm going to talk about this as two things. I think ordination of women and the election of a woman bishop are really the same thing. This is just an added dimension of it. that women were allowed to stand not only for God, which was already shocking, because God, everybody knows God is male. And secondly, I should be careful when it's taped. They might think that you mean it, right? And secondly, that women stand for humanity. And I wish I could think of several stories right off the top of my head on this, except for that what always struck me as a pastor more than any other time in my life is how women do not stand for humanity. We're going to study women, we study women. We're going to have an event, and it says women, then it's only for women. And once in a while you might get sort of a liberated male there, but basically only women will show up. And we learn this early on. We learn it when we look at the Sesame Street characters. And almost all the Sesame Street characters, even Snuffleupagus and Big Bird, are male. Go back and look at them. Mm-hmm. And that says that whenever we're doing something neutral, whenever something stands for everyone, we need he. And that means male. And I've really been thinking about something that I did to my just one of my dearest friends, Roy Satry, who was an assistant to the bishop with me in Southeastern Minnesota Synod. And he came into me one day, and oh, Roy's just a great guy. I love that guy. Anyway, his wife, Dorothy, is on the board here at Holcomb Village. And he walked in and he said, "We've got all this feminine theology. We need some male theology." And I said, "Just pull out any book in my library here." Which was really, it was kind of a lousy thing to say to Roy. But I knew what Roy was saying. What Roy was saying is, I'm so confused by all these things that have happened. I'm starting to wonder what is male and what is positive about being male, and I need some help with this. And that's the problem with brought up in a society, in a world for 2,000 years plus, which has said to be men is the same thing as being human. And if we don't believe that, all we have to do is look at our physician studies. Whenever they're studying sort of a human illness, they basically study men. And we're now going after some of those situations. But so we're just saying again and again and again, to be man is to be universal, to include everybody. To be a woman is to be only covering half of the race. And so I think that's part of the shock of having a woman bishop and a woman pastor. Suddenly that person stands not only for God, in a sense, but also stands for the entire body of Christ and becomes a human symbol and not just a female symbol. Now, you came here to hear my story, so I'll finally get to that. How long have I gone on the other stuff that gets me excited? I'm sharing my story. It always embarrasses me to talk about it, but that is the one thing whenever I am anywhere people ask me to do. So I'm going to try to get through it and keep you awake. Let me tell you just a little bit about where I was born. I was born in Decorah, Iowa, kind of a Norwegian Lutheran community. I think there are 6,000 people there and about 7,000 Norwegian Lutherans. But there were, in my family, we had three girls and then two boys. I think that is not a small thing. In my family, there were no hidden messages that women needed to do things over here and then guys did things over here. I didn't really grow up with, other than my parents wouldn't let me have a motor scooter, other than that, I really can't remember any specific thing that said to me, your world as a woman, April, is limited. I can tell you a million stories hearing that other places, but I don't remember hearing it in my home. I watched my father change a lot of diapers and clean toilets. They needed to be done, cook. And I watched my grandfathers. One died when he's 103, so he was quite a bit older. And I have a grandfather still living who's 87, and I saw them wash dishes, wipe dishes, a little bit of cooking. They didn't know quite so much about cooking, but I never really saw what I experienced from many of my friends saying it was so clear in their family who did what. And I really didn't grow up with that. I think that was an advantage for what has now happened to me in my life. And one of the shocks for me was to just about a month ago to notice that my daughter Katie Larson had written genealogy of our family. And my family's basically immigrant families, Dutch on one side, Norwegian on the other side. And I never thought of my grandmothers or my mothers as anything other than homemakers. And Katie had up on the wall, Grandma Allring, nurse, which she was, gave up when she got married, teacher to my maternal grandmother, and then piano teacher for my mother. And that's true. All of them did those things. But it was interesting to me that my daughter had kind of stretched her imagination. Not that I think homemaker is a very, very positive calling, and I'm very appreciative for what my mother did for all of us children and for my dad. But nevertheless, it's interesting to me that my daughter, on her own, kind of stretched beyond what her mother was able to imagine at that point, that both, she saw both there. So I thank God for my excellent parental models, the pastors in my family, which I think had a lot to do with I have five pastors in my family, had a lot to do with my love of the church. When I was growing up, I read almost exclusively biographies. And they were almost always biographies of men. And I've wondered about that, except for I remember trying to read biographies of women. There usually were one or two in the library. Betsy Ross. Who was the nurse? Okay, those two people, they were always in the library. I have read them, by the way. But, you know, they were really, biographies of women were kind of milquetoast, kind of wimpy visions of women. And these women were not wimpy, but they were kind of portrayed that way, and it really wasn't interesting reading. I think that I think that's a problem for us women. Now, that has changed for already some of our younger women, but when I grew up, I'm 43 years old, when I grew up, there was almost no models, either written or physical or in the church, for women to be any of the kind of dimension that were there for men. And I think that was a real problem, at least for me, as far as my imagination. I grew up then in Decorah, and My mother talks about how, which is true, I always listened to sermons and came home and then I would baptize my sister's dolls and preach and sort of give them sort of the April rehash of the sermon. And then some point in my life, I must have figured it out that I couldn't be a pastor. And I have absolutely no awareness of when that was. It's a totally unconscious event. At some point in my life, I figured out I could either be a secretary, and I remember thinking about this, April, you can be a secretary, you're a terrible typist. Or you can be a nurse, and you're really not so crazy about science. Or you can be a teacher, and you like teaching. So then, what do you want to teach? Well, at that time it was history. I was going to teach history. But I remember just thinking through my options and to be a homemaker. And everybody who's lived with me and all my sisters know I hate to cook. And I don't mind cleaning the house. I like cleaning the house. But the whole thought of being a homemaker for the rest of my life was just terror. Literally terror. So it was very easy. I figured it out, teaching. That's four options you can teach, April. That's what you can do. So that was my career goal. And then when when Judd and I met up at Wilderness Canoe Base up in the Boundary Waters, I was a guide up there, we rapidly became engaged. I had come up engaged to somebody else, but then Judd came into my life and we got engaged. And I won't tell that story, but the whole thing is funny. But then anyway, that was like 22 years ago. And Judd had 2 years left at Luther College, so I was finished. I wasn't quite finished. He had 3 years left at the time we were engaged, but we got married the next summer. And he had then, according to his parents' eyes, 6 years of education because he was going to be a pastor. So he had 2 years at Luther and 4 years of seminary, which was a total heart attack, and I won't go into that story. But anyway, then I taught music for 2 years at a Catholic school. Then we went to seminary, and we were actually the first couple to enter Wartburg Seminary and also finish Wartburg Seminary together. Loved seminary. I wished I could be paid for the rest of my life to go to seminary. What a wonderful experience. When we received a call, clergy couples were a little bit worse than single women. They knew almost what to do with single women because there were two or three women that had been out there in the Midwest that were very good. And it had gone well. But they really didn't know what to do with clergy couples. And so they sent Judd and I to, our bishop sent Judd and I to a call that presently, after 60 years of ministry, I've only met one other pastor who stayed in parish ministry after that call. Most of them were experienced pastors, but that's where we went. It was a tough call. And The one tough thing that happened to me after I'd been there about 3 months is I was looking through one of the files and I found our forms. And if any of you remember the predecessor ALC process, you were certified at the seminary and the teachers evaluated you for ordained ministry, commended you for ordination. Judd's form remained the same. My form was changed by the bishop's office so that I would sound average. And that was kind of tough to see that form. It made me realize, I think the bishop's office was very supportive of women. In fact, I know they were. They were very afraid that if I looked intelligent, they could not get me a call. So they left Judd looking intelligent, but they made me look kind of average. And that was how it was in the olden days when this all started. Those are... Oh, this is. Are you doing okay? Are you here with me? Okay. We served in three different parishes in Iowa and rural parishes. I think I'm probably one of the very few bishops in the whole church that has done almost all of her ministry in rural ministry. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that I was a woman. And where you were placed, and what your opportunities were. They were wonderful opportunities. I don't think there's anything that trains you better for being a bishop. But nevertheless, I think it was more of that's where we had to be, as clergy couples. It's very different now. By the way, bishops fight over clergy couples. I tried to get a clergy couple, and there was no way a new bishop could get a clergy couple in the last draft. No way. In every single parish, Judd always insisted, and we were co-pastors, we shared ministry together, and we're doing a kind of a last session on Saturday, sort of talking about what's happened with my election, how that's changed in our lives. But in serving in three parishes, Judd insisted that I would always do the first wedding, the first funeral, the first confirmation class, and just basically try to help people see April as a pastor. In every single parish, I was always asked, have you ever done a wedding before? Judd has never been asked that in his entire years of ministry. And these are the kinds of things that are just normal, and I tell you, they're still going on. I mean, I sit down with call committees to this day as a bishop and previously as an assistant bishop, and they say, you know, we're not ready for a woman here. And I'll say, well, you know, I have some feelings about that. I'll just do this very briefly, but it was horrid at the time, but one of the fun stories now is a funeral story of this couple that tried to, Judd and I alternated funerals. And this one couple was trying to keep from having a woman do it, having me do it. And they did a lot of finagling. And this woman was buried with the piece of paper, the bulletin which said that Pastor Judd did this funeral. Judd said, I don't care what happens. If you won't do it, April, nobody's doing it. So I ended up doing it, but it was a hostile group. But anyway, buried this woman, and the papers in the casket are Pastor Judd Larson doing the funeral, and the newspaper talked about Pastor Judd Larson doing the funeral, and everybody there, Pastor Judd Larson was officiating, and a number of people in the congregation said to me, you know, I was there. And I saw you do it, Pastor April. And then a tough time, I think, and, you know, I joke about all this, but this stuff is really, it really wears on women. It happens every day. I think about constantly, you know, I'd be their pastor for 3-4 years, I'd baptize a grandchild, I'd bury their spouse, I'd go visit them in the hospital, and they'd say, hello, Pastor April, where is Pastor today? And I learned, after 10 years of parish ministry, I finally learned to say, I'm here with you. And I had to grow to that. Or when I get the phone call and they say, may I speak with Pastor? And I'd say, I'm speaking. Instead of saying, which pastor? Because that automatically assumes that I'm just a little bit nervous yet about who I am. So that's growth. And I share those stories. I know many of you struggle with these same issues in your own vocations, whatever they are. Now, I share this because this was just enormously difficult for me. Even growing up in the kind of family I grew up in, it was just enormously difficult for me to then consider being an assistant to the bishop. For 3 years, I had synods from throughout the United States send me papers saying, you have been nominated for assistant to bishop, and the bishop would write me and say, you know, would you fill out these papers and send them in and allow us to consider your name? And I always threw them in the waste paper basket. It was 3 years of throwing papers like that in the waste paper basket before I came to the point, with a lot of support from other people saying, you know, April, you need to do this. And I think when you listen to women, these are very normal stories. There's nothing unusual about this story. It just kind of moves like that. People struggling to accept the church or whatever it is, or society calling you to do a task, and you say, my goodness, I don't know if I have the gifts to do that. And I was, of course, had a lot of worries about, like, my children would become drug addicts and a number of other things, too. And that was an honest concern. We laugh about it now, but I was very concerned what would happen to my children when I became full-time, because it's different in Synod. It's very difficult in the parish, but it's even your hours and your weird times and your times away are extraordinary as in a Synod office, and I knew that. But Judd said to me, when the Southeastern Minnesota papers came, he said to me, you work all the time anyway. I wish you'd get paid for it. Judd said, I'm not, and then he said, you know, are you filling out those forms? This is a week later. I said, I'm going to fill out the forms. Have you filled out the forms? I'm going to. Don't worry, I'll fill them out. He said, you've had them for a week, and I'm not leaving this office until you fill out those forms. And that, you know, that kind of encouragement from your husband is helpful. I remind him of that when I'm gone too long, that he kind of started this whole thing when I became an assistant. I went to Southeastern Minnesota Synod then, a little bit more than 3.5 years. And then I think another obstacle for me as a woman was the conception of myself as a bishop. And women will tell you, a number of women who have been in the election process will tell you, well, April Larson encouraged me to be a candidate, and I worked hard at encouraging other women to be candidates. And this is a classic for women. We love to have other women do it. We are so good at talking other women into sticking their necks out, but it's really hard for us to say yes. And let me tell you this story, because it is kind of a funny one. I was assistant to the bishop at Southeastern Minnesota Synod, and I received a phone call about a year and 5 months ago in February. And they asked, this woman, who was a pastor, asked me if she could place my name in nomination for bishop in La Crosse Area Synod. And she said, she told me her name, and she said, I met you at Anaheim, California, at the 20th anniversary of the ordination of women. I did not remember her. She said she had seen me up front leading some music and had thought I would like to have that woman for my bishop. Doesn't sound very discerning, does it? What does a musician know about being a bishop? But anyway, so she asked me, and I said yes. And one of the reasons I said yes is because I knew that I would not be elected. That was a different synod and a different region. If you know anything about the ELCA, the synod, even though we were across the river, we had almost nothing to do with each other. I didn't know any pastors in that synod. I had never been to any region events with any of those assistants, the bishops or pastors or anything. I just didn't know those folks. And so I thought, this is very safe. Our church never elects women. It never elects bishops from some other synod. I can say yes, and then I can look at all these other women in the eye and say, April, you know, I let my name go in to one of the processes. So I did it, and then I got a phone call about a month later, and in this synod, it's La Crosse Area Synod is unique, and I think that's probably has one of the reasons why a woman was elected there. They have clusters nominate people, and then the top three from clusters go into a possibility of 12 names. Now, if you're nominated in more than one cluster, then that reduces the possibility of numbers of names. They have four clusters or four conferences, and they met in February, each one of them, and they nominated three people. Well, I got one phone call, and I didn't know a thing about this synod, nothing about this synod. I knew who the bishop was, that was it, and he was retiring. So they called me up and asked me to do this, and then they call me up and say, you were number two in our cluster. Out of the three, there were many names nominated, but the three top, you were number two. So I hung up the phone and I went to bed and I said to Judd, we don't have to worry about anything. I think there are 16 clusters, and I was nominated in one of them, but we don't have to worry about anything. So then I got a phone call a few days later, and this person's really cranked up. They woke me up. It was 11 o'clock at night, woke me up. Said, you were number one in our cluster. So I said to this pastor, because I had gotten material, I'd gotten a sheet of paper from the first person who nominated me about these forums that were coming up in April, and we had to go around to each cluster and speak, and I had thrown the paper away because I didn't need to hang on to it. And so I said to this pastor, I said, well, if I ever have to worry about those forum things, let me know. And she said, April, you're in the forums. So then I had to reschedule some things so I could be there for those 3 days of forums. Then I found out from Norma Everest, this is quite a story, Norma Everest, who's a professor at Wartburg Seminary. And she wrote me a note and she said, I understand that you were in the top three in three out of four clusters. So there was a third cluster in which I was a third. That's how I found out there were four clusters. I didn't know there were four clusters. As you know, I thought there were 16. And even at that point, I didn't know I was the leading nominee. Now, any guy would figure out right away what's going on here. I mean, I walked into those forums, and I was absolutely positive that out of the seven total candidates that ended up having, that I was the bottom one. Now, how could that be? I was the only one that was nominated in three clusters. Some were nominated in one, and a couple were nominated in two. But I knew that I was the bottom. And I promised my bishop and my children and my husband that there was no chance I would be elected. And I believed it. And I remember, got elected. The last thing you want to think is that you got there because somebody finagled the system in any way. You have to at least think maybe it was God, or you'll never get through it. So, no, I didn't. I just requested that. And they, as far as I know, followed that. There was a lot of accusations after I was elected that there was campaigning. Bishop Contorpson believed that women pastors had done some manipulating, so he spent his entire summer checking on it. And after he checked on it, found out there had been quite a few phone calls and campaign done for the male candidates, but none for me, which was a good feeling to know once I started as a bishop. I don't really think it's so terrible to campaign, but I just needed to not have it done for me. Then on the day of the election, I should also tell you that nobody talked to me. This started in February, and the election was on June 11th or 12th. Nobody talked to me. It was silence. It was just agony. I mean, I didn't know when I went in those forums, you know, I didn't know if those clusters that had nominated me, if I had embarrassed them, or if they were really sorry they had nominated me, and nobody said anything. It was just silence. And I talked to the first person who nominated me about that after it was all over, and she said, well, you know, he told us not to do any campaign, so he didn't do any campaign. We didn't call you either. But anyway, the first day that then that ballot started, that first ballot, and they announced the ballot, and it was 94 votes for me and 50 for the next highest person. And I knew when I heard that I didn't hear the vote right. So I asked another person, and they said, well, you know, you have 94 and the next highest is 50. So I knew they hadn't heard it right either. I mean, that's the truth. I asked three different people. And really, you know, from that moment, you know, it's scary. And then you think, okay, that's just for a little while here, because once this shrinks down and everybody then votes for this, there'll be one of these other guys that will rise up, because I have always said that the church flirts with women but never marries them. And that we want to have women in our top three nominees. It's very important to us, but we don't want them as bishop. And we've made that very, very clear in a number of elections in which I think we've had extremely qualified women, and they haven't been elected. And so I just, even then, I really wasn't until it was down to that second last ballot in which I already had a majority, and there was no way that I could not get elected on the fifth ballot then, that I had to face it. And came home, and, you know, I told my kids, the last thing I said to my kids is, don't worry. You know, there's no chance I will be elected. And of course, I get home, and the place is just filled with flowers. And I wasn't even dead. And so that's kind of the story of my election. I don't know if that's exactly the way I had this written out here. I was going to talk about, there's a number of things I wanted to talk to you about, but I think I ran out of time, and maybe we can do it in another session. But I wanted to talk about, let me just do one thing, and then we'll open it up for discussion. I think, now when I was an assistant to the bishop, and I hope if you ever repeat this, you repeat this in the kindness in which I say it, but we just absolutely have to talk about these things or we can't do anything about it. So I'm going to talk about it. When I was assistant to the bishop, and I came on, I think, one of the best synod staffs in the church, and that staff at Southeastern Minnesota Synod, just fantastic. I love every one of those people. But when I came on that staff, it was really tough. It was really tough. And I think what happened, and this is April's theory, I don't have anything to back it up. It makes you a problem in academic circles right away, but this is my theory. We talk about, for instance, South Africa, the black people, you know, they just can't get their act together. You got all these tribes that are fighting all the time. Mm-hmm. And then we talk about multicultural people, and we say, my goodness, you know, they just can't get their stuff together. They can't agree on something. Well, I think, you know, you've got, I won't name the group here, but you've got one group that's got most of the power. And then you have, that's probably too much of the pie there, it's probably more like just a little part here. But when I came on staff, Southeastern Minnesota Synod, those other women already there, here's April, there's two pastor assistants, Roy Satry and myself, and the bishop. And those people basically, if you understand the synod structure in the ELCA, basically do the same stuff. Bishops and assistants basically do the same work. And then you have your other staff. We had an administrative assistant to the bishop who basically ran the money and was an office manager and that kind of a, she was called assistant to the bishop, but she basically was not a pastoral assistant and did not do work like the pastors on the synod staff. And I think when I came on, which happens a lot, people always say, why are women so often the ones that are the most after you in a parish? Why is it always women that are picking on the woman pastor, which I don't agree with anyway, but people say that. Don't you get your worst opposition from women? Well, it was tough coming into that staff. But those women thought, and this is my perception of it, those women thought they just got a tiny piece of authority and power, and I'm talking about authority and power as the ability to get something done. Trying to do something, and you can get it done, because you've got the power and the authority to get it done. So they've got this little dab of power and authority here, and they think, oh my goodness, April comes in, she gets the biggest chunk of it. She gets all this. We got to give up the little bit we've earned for over a year in this staff. We've got to give it up, and most of it we got to give up to April. Now, how do you think they're going to feel about that? That's pretty tough, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So I kept talking to Nick and Roy in the nicest way I could about how my chunk needed to come out of here. And that what I thought was going on was that the women, I mean, I think have some pretty good basis for that, have some anxiety about who's going to give up power and authority to let April into the staff. Now, that was just the first year, and it got wonderful, and it wasn't terrible even that year, although it was very difficult for me because I kept worrying about these women, and I knew that this is where I needed to get my space. And I didn't follow anybody. That position wasn't there. It was a new position. Whenever you get into a new position, that means people giving up some stuff. And it was tough. But I think about that when you're watching, when you're into a position where you're seeing people who are also don't have all that authority and power, and they're the ones that are making it tough for you. Think about what the real dynamics are. And I think we do need to press as women to get into, and I would say that also people of color, whatever, we have to keep pressing into those areas in which the power is. And I'm defining power as the ability to get something done, to make change. So that's one heavy in the middle of a lot of light stories there. Now you go ahead if you have any questions. If not, I'll give you some more to chew on.
Most familiar with the collegiate athletic world, and in the late 70s, early 80s, it was very clear that women were on the move in that field, and the male athletic directors became running wild and scared, and they knew that they had to be more inclusive with females in administrative positions, somewhat similar to what you're facing as the one and only female bishop. And what has happened in the athletic world is they've gotten one or two women on in their important positions and their board of directors and all, but it still is predominantly male run. So I'm wondering if you have some insight on whether you are going to be alone as a bishop, or if there's any, you know, future for two or three women bishops instead of just one.
Well, I am. Have always prayed for women bishops. I think it's just critically important to have women bishops, and I think it affects the whole church. And I have moments of terror in which I worry that it'll be a chunk of time, that this is kind of a fluke thing because of the process. There's a process in La Crosse Area Synod that you don't have in most synods, and that was all those people heard me talk at forums. And it was a fair process. It was a different kind of a forum. We had a limited period of time to talk, and we had only a minute to respond when asked a question. Everybody got a minute. I've watched a lot of other synods do forums, but they don't regulate the time, and it really puts women at a disadvantage, despite the fact that we are always said to be the one, the talkative sex. Women find it extremely difficult to do what they call interrupt. And to make it fair, we need to have rules that everybody follows the same, regardless of our sex. And I will talk a lot about it. If you read some of these books about how we all talk differently as male and female, you see right away that if you just have a process that's open, one of the points of that book, and I can't remember the author, is at the end, she states, she actually puts down a lot of things that we call sexist as not being sexist, but she finally says at the end, the one thing we do know, and she's a language expert.
Deborah Tanner.
Thank you. The last thing she does say, when we get together, when we have mixed groups like we have right now, then we use male rules for conversation. So women know female rules and male rules, but we don't learn those as children because we play with girls and boys play with boys. So we have to learn them later on in life, which always means we're just stretching a little bit as women and puts us at a disadvantage in any kind of a mixed setting. And so that really helped at that forum that it was fair. Everybody had a 5-minute presentation. Everybody had 1 minute to answer any question, or you could decline not to answer it. And I think the forums are what did it. Because people, I mean, I didn't have any idea. Nobody came up and talked to me afterwards. But it was the forums that caused people to get to know in some way this woman. And I think our other processes in which we have an ecclesiastical ballot, which I have always supported and I'm having a lot of second thoughts about, I think it's very, very difficult for a woman to be elected. Because you don't get that exposure. People don't hear if you are competent. What do we always wonder about women? Can they do it? Are they competent? And in fact, they are, but give them a chance. Hear them. Sharon.
I was just going to respond to Ann in at April Larson's encouragement. I had my name put in and was elected to a new committee in Southeast Minnesota. on the election committee on the election commission. And we called for nominations, much like La Crosse Synod did. And then it was up to our committee to guarantee that there would, or ensure that there would be inclusivity on that committee. We could then put in other, our committee could then put in other names, which we did because we didn't get women's names nominated. And we were up against it because we had a popular bishop that we knew would be reelected, but we were laying the groundwork for future years in this process. And we did indeed put in the names of two women. One, a woman of color that we brought from the East Coast,
who was
marvelous, in three forums that took place in our synod. Our bishop was reelected on the first ballot, but I think it's only as we become, people were impressed who attended those forums with those two women. And I think it's going to have to become a very intentional thing.
Yes, and that is why I have always worked so hard for the nominations of women, particularly for them to speak. Because nothing happens until our imaginations change. And Walter Brueggemann argues this, but I believe this with all my heart. The first thing we have to do is imagine something different. You can't get people to vote for something that they've never even thought of. So first of all, you have to get into the imagining. And it's no small piece that in La Crosse Area Synod, 5 years ago or 6 years ago in the first, after the merger, that there was a woman nominee. And none of us have the opportunities that we have. I think constantly of the enormous amount of people, women and men, who have made it possible for me to have the opportunity that I have to be a bishop. Some days I don't think it's an opportunity, but but it's an opportunity for women to have that possibility. And but we have to always begin with imagining, and that absolutely goes for everything. I mean, civil rights movement, I mean, how many decades did black people in their churches sing of a different day and speak to each other and say Mr. Smith or Mrs. Jones and talk to each other respectively? as they were not receiving in society, but imagining a different day and becoming empowered by imagining a different day. I think our imagination is the key to change.
April, it's one of the men in the room. I'd like to say, at least for myself, that I feel much better being in a church with you and in this vision. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And my question is, I noticed on the bio on the kiosk that there's another female bishop in our church, but not in the States, in another country. I didn't know where or who, but wondering whether you knew something of her story, and I imagine it would parallel yours, but might be different in some details, and also whether the two of you are in contact in terms of, I mean, it feels the Adam story and Eve story, but not good to be alone. That you have a certain amount of solidarity and collaboration.
Oh, it's wonderful. Those are wonderful questions. First of all, Maria Jepson was elected in April. I was elected in June in Germany, first woman bishop in the world, Lutheran. First Lutheran woman bishop in the world. She's a fourth cousin of one of my very, very closest friends, Joan Mao. And I kind of have a funny story about that. This is long before I ever thought I'd be a bishop. I was just ecstatic, you know, that she was elected. And I call up my good friend Joan Mao because she's German in her background and spent many years in Germany. And I said, Joan, do you know this Maria Jepson? And can you get me her address? And she said, oh, no, I've never heard of her. So then I read in the Lutheran that Karl Mao, which is Joan's father, and Maria Jepson are fourth cousins. So I really gave her a hard time after that. I am going to see her this summer. And we haven't really written to each other, but Karl Mao was in her installation, and he asked me for a verse, a scriptural verse, which he then used with her. So we have been doing more verbal things between people that we know, and I got a greeting from her just a few weeks ago from Joan Mao, who had spent some time with her. So
where is she in Germany? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know. I have an article on her, but not with me. And then you probably know that Norway just elected, not elected, they don't elect. Norway appointed a woman bishop just in the last couple of months. And I have an article on her that's in Swedish that I cannot read, or Norwegian. It'd probably be in Norwegian, right? No, it's in Swedish. The Swedish people reported it. So do we have anybody who reads Swedish around here?
I don't know.
So, good questions. If you don't have to go only to questions, I mean, if you want to just chew at each other, that's great.
I think you're right about the imagination, and that when you talk about the objection both to women pastors and to women bishops, I think part, in addition to the things that you identified, there's that fear of the unknown.
Yes.
And when the unknown comes in, it reveals things that we wouldn't otherwise see, and I think that's one of the most fascinating things about your story, is that it illumines for us a lot about the process of how leadership is surfaces in our current polities, which do vary from synod to synod.
Yes,
and as we've listened to the stories of various women who were nominated and didn't, who were not elected, I'm always fascinated by, well, what was it about the process that was part of that? And when is the process something that is along with the Spirit?
Yes.
And when is it inhibiting of the Spirit? And
yes.
And it's, I don't think it's an easy correlation.
No.
It's not an easy correlation at all. And so we can't say, well, this process is perfect and that one is flawed, but rather that we need to always be thinking about that. What are we doing as human beings that allows or doesn't allow the Spirit's work? And the issue of women being pastors or women being bishops is one place that illumines it, but other people get caught in it as well, and we just didn't know it before.
I think I worked very intimately with the process that was developed at Southeastern Minnesota Synod. And what was in the forefront of my mind was constantly to keep that inclusive and to keep it open. I thought as I worked in the synod office that we really ought to have two processes in our synods. We ought to have an ecclesiastical ballot for an incumbent bishop,
mm-hmm.
because you still could get rid of them if you don't like them. But on the other hand, you're not getting your bishop to tie up almost a year of their time in this election process, which is really a really bad use of their time. But whenever you've got our bishop retiring or coming to the end of their terms, in other words, in many cities it's 3 terms, and you're 12 years, you're done no matter what if you haven't died first. I wonder about it some days. But anyway, but then to have that kind of a process, I think ecclesiastical ballot in that kind of situation isn't good. Unless you've done some really poor work as an assistant, it almost assures that one of the assistants will be elected, and then it's very, very difficult for any pastor who isn't extremely well known in the synod, maybe a senior pastor that's been there for 15 years, or an assistant, to have any chance in the process. And it flies in the face of what we believe as Lutherans. We believe very strongly that a pastor, any pastor of the church that has the gifts, can be called to be a bishop in any part of the church, or any pastor in any pastoral call any place. That's a very fundamental part of our theology. And yet we do have a system here that doesn't open it up and makes it very, very difficult for people of color or women to be elected.
Or young people.
I'm pretty young. I'm just teasing.
That might be something that people in their synods could check into, because our committee was called, I got a letter one day and said, our committee's been called back into action. Oh goodness, what happened to Nick? But it was to fine tune or to relook and make some recommendations about the process and the groundwork that we developed in southeastern Minnesota. And so one thing that we did was decide, well, let's find out what some other synods are doing. And we probably checked, you know, wrote to like 15 or 20 synods. And what we learned is that very few synods have any kind of a process except the ecclesiastical ballot. And they said, when you get yours done, let us know what you're doing, because, you know, we'd like to look. And so that would be something you could do in your synods, is to see what the process is. If it's not intentional, it's going to happen.
And all you need would be a simple resolution that would get passed at your synod to gather a committee together. And if you're smart, you would maybe even have some people in mind or something, or some process to make that also open. A committee together to study the processes of other synods and then make a recommendation. And I think if you just say, let's study the process, you're likely to continue with what you have. But study the process of other synods. If people start looking at other processes and seeing what happens, they might be more inclined to open that up. So, well, you people.
This is maybe a different question, but is there something that's coming before the churchwide assembly this year to change the constitution to make the terms of bishops 2 6-year rather than?
This is just a riot, because I was on that subcommittee prior to, mm-hmm. I'm on the task force in the study of ministry, and I was on the subcommittee. We broke into subcommittees doing different things, and I was on bishops. And having lived in a synod office and watching, you know, my bishop really waste 9 months of his time messed up with this kind of a process, I thought this is really a bad use of time. Southwestern Minnesota Synod, which is, you know, kind of your, and I don't know if it's all Haugi Norwegians, but there's a lot of that kind of background there, have always brought resolutions to the whole churchwide about, let's have 2 6-year terms of bishops. And the churchwide has always said, you can't do it. Even if you want to do it over there, you can't do it. Everybody's got to have 4-year terms. So then our task force comes up with this idea of 6-year terms. And it's Gracia Grindle, do you know anything about Gracia, and April, and one other person, we got 6-year terms. And all of a sudden I'm reading all this material about how the bishops are trying to take over the church, and, you know, we're going to have 6-year terms so we don't have to be accountable to people. You know, I'm reading all this stuff and I'm thinking, my goodness, this came right out of, you know, your free church, Haugi Lutheran Norwegian people on the task force who came up with a 6-year term, which really came out of southwestern Minnesota. And one of the synods that was most worked up with it were people in southwestern Minnesota synod. I could not believe it. So now I have to say, I've always been for term limits. And I think 12 years is plenty as a bishop. And I do think, even now, as a bishop, that even though we don't have much authority compared to Roman Catholics or even Methodists, we've got enough that we should lay that thing aside after a while and go back to the parish. And we should not be bishops for 30 years. I think 12 is probably 2 years too much. And I have some strong feelings about that. And that didn't get passed in the task force. Term limits didn't get passed, but the church council added that. And I think that's good. But it's not true. There wasn't any indication. I mean, this came out of your sort of your most free church people in the task force who said, let's have 6 year term limits and not high people. That's a chunk of time. That's money. That's time. That's, I think, wasted. It's wasted. Generally, people are going to re-elect their bishop unless they're pretty unhappy or some fluky thing happens. It's really a waste of people's time. I think you feel that way, even though you worked so hard on that election, although it was really good to raise up some other people, some women, I think. Well, people, thank you so much for, I think there were only a couple of you that needed to take a nap. I don't blame you in this room either. We'll talk about Eve if you come back tomorrow.
Ich bin nicht ganz sicher, aber das wird sich interessieren.